And Brescianella's Violin Concerto in E minor introduces another edition of the Little Wireless program. We often address the issue of apps and algorithms and their impact on the world wherein we dwell and on our own personal lives, but you can't necessarily live happy ever after, if you forgive an appalling pun, because so many things, even great breakthrough innovations, fail. They don't work terribly well. And then we get exasperated. So we were sympathetic to a piece we read, which was headed Not Hail the Innovators, but Hail the Maintainers, with the following subheading: Capitalism excels at innovation, but is failing at maintenance. And for most lives, it is maintenance that matters more. So a little later in the program, we are going to sing the praises of the maintainers. On the 15th of April, 1989, a beautiful spring day by all accounts, the FA Cup semi-final between Liverpool and Nottingham Forest was due to start at 3 at the Hillsborough Stadium in Sheffield, with thousands of Liverpool fans still outside the ground with less than 10 minutes to kick off. The police made the fatal decision to open a side gate to relieve pressure outside the ground. The result of that decision was the deaths of 96 Liverpool fans as they were crushed by the crowd that surged in. Now, in the days after the disaster, Liverpool fans, already grieving, were further punished by police and media, who were putting the blame for the deaths on them, accusing them of drunkenness, entering without tickets, and even pickpocketing the dead. 27 years later, a jury has handed down a finding that exonerates the fans and puts the blame squarely at the feet of the police. Now, our next guest has been working towards this outcome for most of those 27 years, Professor Phil Scraton. You'll know Phil because he's been on the program any number of times in the past. We've discussed, yes, Hillsborough, but we've also talked about the Bolger case and kids living in conflict in Northern Ireland. But he was on the independent panel that handed down a report in 2012 that meant that the previous inquest finding of accidental death was quashed and a new inquest ordered. Phil's day job, professor of the law school at Queen's University in Belfast, and it's from Belfast he joins us. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's great to be back to speaking with you again.
How did your involvement begin?
It began because it was probably only the second semi-final I'd missed in years. I had very young children. They now have children. And at that time, I was at home, and my son came into the room and said, "Something terrible is happening at Hillsborough. It's on the television." And I said, "The match isn't televised." And he said, "No, something has happened and is happening." And I looked, and there you could see this terrible crush in the pens, people being pulled out. And you knew immediately there was a dreadful tragedy unfolding. And that evening I went into Liverpool, my home city, and I met people coming back off coaches and trains, and they were all telling the same story, that there'd been a crush outside, as you've just described, an exit gate had been opening, and they didn't surge in. They walked in a quite straightforward and calm manner. But when they walked through that exit gate, what they saw ahead of them was a tunnel, and they went down it. What they didn't know, they were going into the back of already full pens. There was no policing, no stewarding. And they told me this story. I knew immediately, having been at so many football matches, I knew immediately what had happened from their description. And, of course, that was the story as it unfolded. But within days, the police had met amongst themselves, and I have now all the records of those meetings. and a completely different story was put out. And it was the story as you described it, that many fans had arrived drunk without tickets, that they'd stormed through the gate once it had been opened, that they'd rushed down the tunnel into the backs of their fellow fans. And basically the story, as was said, was Liverpool people killed Liverpool people. And that massaging of the truth that in the immediate week, Kelvin McKenzie's newspaper, The Sun, ran with a headline, The Truth. And the headline he'd wanted to use was, You Scum. And his political editor talked him out of it. And that's the day that all the allegations were published. And of course, in all newspapers they were published. And from my point of view, from that moment onwards, we knew that we had to do something about this massaging of the truth and the lies that were being told. And in actual fact, the match commander, David Duckenfield, he had already issued to the newspapers on the day itself the fact that Liverpool fans had broken in. He did not accept immediate responsibility for opening the gates, that they'd broken through the gates. So what we saw emerging was that while people were coming to identify their loved ones in body bags on the gymnasium floor, and at that point there were over 80 in body bags, while that was actually happening on the same day, a completely different narrative was being published. And we formed the Hillsborough Project, and we had support from the Liverpool City Council. We wrote our first report in 1990. We wrote our second in 95. I published Hillsborough The Truth, the book, in 1999, revealing not only the dreadful situation that occurred and why it had occurred, but also criticizing the accidental death verdicts that had been delivered by the first inquests. And when I did that, I thought, this is it. And in fact, although there were two senior officers prosecuted, and in terms of the most senior officer, David Duckenfield, it was a hung jury, I thought, this is the moment. And then the fans had to wait till 2009 and the 20th anniversary, when the decision was taken to release all of the documents from all of the authorities. And that's when the Hillsborough Independent Panel was appointed. I headed its research, and we gathered over 2 million documents. We now online have, at the press of a mouse, we have online the main documents all there for everybody to read, and we wrote the 400-page Hillsborough Independent Panel report, which exonerated the fans and laid the responsibility at the door of the police mainly, but also at other authorities. And to conclude that kind of comment, really, that was the moment that the decision was taken to run new inquests, hold new inquests, quash the original verdict. An apology from the Prime Minister, apology to the families from the Home Secretary, and then the new inquests began, and they finished this week.
Now, Crompton, Chief Constable Crompton, has been suspended over police management of the inquest for taking such an adversarial approach. He wasn't involved, however, in the original catastrophe.
No, that's absolutely correct. The Chief Constable at the time was Peter Wright, and he made it very clear after we'd had an investigation it was a Home Office inquiry led by Lord Justice Taylor. He made it very clear, Lord Justice Taylor found the senior officers to have lied to his inquiry, to have exaggerated, and to have abdicated all responsibility. So in the aftermath of that, Peter Wright, the then Chief Constable, stated clearly that a different story would emerge at the initial inquest, and that's exactly what happened. What happened this time was that although Crompton, the current Chief Constable, who, as you say, has been suspended, although he made an apology after the Hillsborough Panel's report came out in 2012, although he made what appeared to be a full apology, he and his force ran as you described, exactly the same kind of defense of their senior officers that they had done at the first inquest. What this meant was an inquest that should have been heard, and of course all of our inquests in serious matters such as this are heard before a jury, inquests that should have been through in 9 months to a year were dragged out over 2 years, and that meant that families were going up to Warrington where the inquests were held every day and being put through the mill yet again of hearing all those allegations that my book, my research, and also the Hillsborough Independent Panel report had actually discounted and demonstrated through all the documentation were not true. They were dragged back up to the courts again. And of course, the whole issue lasted for an extra year. And I've been on secondment to the legal teams throughout that period. And then, of course, what that led to this week is the most damning verdict that has ever been issued in a coroner's court.
I watched with interest the minister telling the story in the House of Parliament, and she seemed to be genuinely angry and moved. It seems that that at long last people are facing up to the collective responsibility.
Yes, the Home Secretary Theresa May supported the Hillsborough Independent Panel. She supported its findings, and she was very clear that the families would have their full hearing. I think what she felt, what were her emotions yesterday, were clearly informed by the points I was making. That there she was now with an unlawfully killed verdict, majority verdict of the jury, which is the term in law is gross negligence manslaughter. She had that verdict now delivered by a jury. There was also, we have narrative verdicts in our courts, so they can give you the short verdict, which is unlawful killing, but then can then tell the story. There were 16 major criticisms made of the police at all levels. There were two major omissions identified in the way in which the local authority had allowed the planning application to go through for the stadium. There were six criticisms laid against this soccer club. This was a neutral ground for a semi-final. Six major criticisms against the soccer club. But also the ambulance service had three major criticisms levelled against them. In other words, there were 25 findings against those who had responsibility for the safety of those fans.
What about the Sun? Did they ever apologise?
Well, I'm just coming to that because the interesting issue is that against those 25 findings that were put up to the authorities, the most significant finding, and the jury was asked this directly, was that the fans' behavior played no part in the deaths. That was such an important part of the verdict. And the reason it's important is precisely the point you've just made. In the week after the disaster, the Sun published that dreadful, scurrilous headline, but so did a lot of other newspapers publish it. And they have tried to apologize, but no one will buy the Sun on Merseyside. It's almost an outlawed paper on Merseyside. But my argument always had been that somebody of Kelvin McKenzie's status running a national newspaper, whatever we think of it, it was the most popular newspaper in the UK. He must have got that story from somewhere. And what I'd been able to demonstrate was that on the night of the disaster and the forthcoming days, three senior officers, plus a local Conservative member of Parliament, plus the head of the Police Federation, had all gone to see a news agency called White's in Sheffield, and they fed the story. White's then fed the story, and I've got the story, actually, as it was sent out on the wires. They fed that story then to all newspapers. The Sun was the worst offender in terms of going forward with that dreadful headline, The Truth, when they knew they had nothing but those statements to back it up. But the other newspapers published it also. So what we saw there was an orchestrated attempt right at the beginning to change the narrative publicly, and people believed it.
Phil, I have to congratulate you on your tenacity, and I would remind the listeners that the book Hillsborough, The Truth, published by Mainstream Publishing, is still out there awaiting purchase. And Phil, we occasionally give an award on this program to guests who performed above and beyond the call of duty. It's called the Koala Stamp. It doesn't have a physical embodiment, but I'm presenting you with the Koala Stamp, and congratulations. Philip Scraton from the School of Law, Queen's University in Belfast. And as I said, he was on the Hillsborough Independent panel, which wrote a report on the disaster. And the ongoing story is very largely a consequence of his efforts. This is LNL on RN. Coming up, as promised, a hymn of praise to the Maintainers. As you know, beloved listeners, this little wireless program is totally committed to our government's ideas boom. Why? Well, I remember distinctly having an idea, I think about 15 years ago, and RN, the network, promotes itself as the Ideas Network. So when our beloved PM talks of innovation and science driving the jobs of the 21st century, we want to help out. So, as I said earlier, we were a little shocked to discover that innovation may be a bit overvalued, that even in the home of Silicon Valley, there's a new mantra: not hail the innovators, but hail the maintainers. And that's the title of a recent essay by two US technology historians, Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel. What happens after innovation, and I'm quoting from their text, is more important. Maintenance and repair, the building of infrastructures, the mundane labour that goes into sustaining functioning and efficient infrastructures simply has more impact on people's daily lives than the vast majority of technological innovations. So what happens when the app that was going to fix the problem isn't working, or Google's self-driving car falls into a pothole because the road hasn't been repaired? Via Skype from his home in New Jersey, Lee Vinsel. Lee is Assistant Professor of Science and Technology Studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. Welcome to our little wireless program. I have to ask you, Stevens, who is or was he?
The Stevens family, well, thank you very much for having me on. The Stevens family actually was kind of landed gentry in the early American Republic, and then they put a good deal of their money into experimenting with steam technology and built early ships that were used for transport around the United States.
Well, it's quite an appropriate patronage for you, isn't it, Lee? Now, how did this concept of innovation become the dominant ideology, or a dominant ideology of our time?
It's one of those social phenomena that don't have a single source, but come from a lot of different places. One of the places we focus on, though, are some American economists in the 1950s and 1960s, like Robert Salow and Kenneth Arrow. And what these economists found is that traditional factors for explaining economic growth, like capital and education, simply could not explain the growth they were seeing. And so what they hypothesized was that technology was really the key to economic growth. And then through the technological change, that is, and then through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, they found more and more that that was the case. So once that was found to be true, the question becomes, how do you unlock the secrets of innovation, and how do you change society to increase innovation? And that's when we get into questions about whether we're doing the right thing and whether we can really control innovation in that way.
Lee, by the beginning of the century, you argue, innovation had become an erotic fetish, enlisting liberals and conservatives alike. I find that bipartisanship interesting.
Yes, it's very true. I mean, I think part of what we're looking at is that innovation as a term can be very vague, as many buzzwords are. And so in the American context, what that means is that conservatives, Republicans, can say that they are trying to increase innovation by cutting taxes, for instance, on corporations or the wealthy. And then Democrats can say they're trying to spur on innovation by creating government programs or giving more research money to universities and other things like that. So its vagueness kind of allows for all kinds of things to be done in its name.
Are you hearing this this term in your current pre-presidential kerfuffle? We're deafened by the term in our pre-election time here in Australia.
Yes. Well, I mean, we hear it from presidential candidates all the time, for sure. I mean, and this kind of goes to the bipartisan issue that you're talking about. We hear it from Trump, we hear it from Clinton, and we even hear it from Bernie Sanders. So all across the political spectrum, the word rings out.
I'm going to quote here, conservative politicians could put government, could gut government and cut taxes in the name of spurring entrepreneurship, while liberals could create new programs aimed at fostering research. When did innovation bashing start, and why? Who can I congratulate?
I think that because it is such a buzzword and is so ubiquitous in culture, people have been getting pretty sick of it for the last 5 to 10 years. You see people like the design expert Michael Beirut talk about innovation is the new black, was an essay he wrote some years ago, about 10 years ago, actually. But yeah, I think in the last couple years, especially, scholars, historians of technology have been turning on it quite a bit and saying this doesn't really get at the bigger issues.
So have you and your collaborator been celebrated within Silicon Valley?
Has our paper been celebrated?
Yeah, yes. Are you being carried shoulder high through cheering crowds?
We're being carried shoulder high through some cheering crowds, but I wouldn't say necessarily that the Silicon Valley crowd is one of them. Actually,
they're jeering rather than cheering, yeah, I take it.
I think so. Actually, a couple days ago, the former CEO of Politico, which is a news site here in the United States, just said that he wanted to form something called the Innovation Party, which he wanted to be run by Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, of course. So some communities in our nation have not gotten the memo yet on this.
I noticed that as early as 2012, even the Wall Street Journal, you know, which is that most sacred of texts, got into an innovation bashing act. They noted that the term has begun to lose meaning, and counted, and I find this extraordinary, more than 250 books with innovation in the title.
Yeah, exactly. I've done a lot of using databases to just track the rise of the word innovation in different contexts, and one of the things I did was look at books written by Harvard Business School professors. And it's just amazing to go through the 70s and then the 80s and the 90s and literally watch every subsequent book have more and more instances of innovation in it. So, in the 90s and the early 2000s, it really took off and was just everywhere.
Let's now introduce the group of workers you call the Maintainers. Who are they?
I think it's a good question, and part of the issue that we're dealing with is because our culture has so celebrated innovators and written books and movies about such people, I think we don't have a good picture of who the maintainers are. But the reality is that if we think of innovation as simply the introduction of new things into the world, then the vast majority of work, including work with technology, is not focused on innovation. It's focused on keeping things going. So maintainers are all around us. They're the people who fix utility poles or maintain utility poles. They're the people who route out the sewers when there's a problem. They keep up everything. And so I think they're kind of anonymous.
They're not as dramatic as the first responders, but they're there slugging it out, and often with awesome jobs and ever-diminishing budgets.
That's right. And I think part of what our problem in our culture is that we lack stories about how these people are valuable. You know, I think that we don't know who the great maintainers are. We know who Edison and a bunch of famous inventors are, but who are the people who are really great at maintaining? We just don't know that story.
You had a conference recently about these unsung heroes, the maintainers, and there were quite a few papers given. I note that one was called Maintenance Deferred, Slow Disaster, and the Politics of Infrastructural Decay. That sounds pretty ominous. Tell us about it.
That's my friend Scott Knowles, who's at Drexel University, which is a lot like Stevens. It's in Philadelphia. And this is gets at an interesting comparative issue, because I don't know how things are in Australia around infrastructure, but in the United States, we've known since the late 70s, after doing a lot of infrastructure building from the 30s to the 60s, we just kind of let it stagnate. And so we've had a lot of problems, infrastructural failures of various sorts.
Including, of course, some very, very spectacular bridge collapse.
That's right. And more recently, it's about the subways in Washington, D.C. and New York, and how deferred maintenance has, for instance, led to fires in Washington, D.C. So Scott's argument, he calls it slow disaster, is that what we see when we don't invest in our infrastructure and keep it up is just that, slow disasters unveiling slowly. And it's not the kind of catastrophic thing you might see with Katrina, but it's more all around us all the time, less seen, but still a big problem.
One of the industries which does seem to make heroes out of the maintainers would, I suspect, be aviation, where, yes, there's a high level of innovation, but most of the companies that build aircraft are very concerned that they fly safely for as long as possible.
Yeah. One thing we haven't really written about yet, but we're very interested in, is there is a, if you look into the term maintainers, the maintainers in the Air Force are all the men, mostly men, some women, who keep the Air Force going, right? I mean, most of the people in the Air Force are not pilots. They're people who upkeep the jets and other equipment. So actually, if your audience is on Facebook, they can look into this thing called maintainer humor. And I'll warn them that some of the jokes are pretty sexist and tawdry, but it kind of gets at how there are whole cultures of maintainers out there, and even some of them are, kind of self-conscious, like these Air Force guys.
For your conference, you wanted people to talk about whether innovation and maintenance in our digital world differs profoundly from earlier technological systems. Lee, was there any consensus on this?
Yeah, I think the consensus is that although we like to think of the digital world as some kind of radical discontinuity with the industrial past, it isn't. And the best paper on this, I thought, well, there were two good papers, but the one I'll talk about was by Nathan Ensminger. And Nathan, he's a historian of technology at Indiana University, and he showed in his papers that most computer scientists are not creating new software. They're not coders necessarily. They keep existing digital systems in organizations and around us everywhere going, including by fixing code and other problems. So I think that, you know, the rhetoric of Silicon Valley and the kind of things we see in TED Talks and whatnot are always about the new and the novel and how that's going to revolutionize our lives. But even when we look at digital technologies, maintenance and upkeep turn out to be the most important things.
You've got a very powerful argument in the book, which I'm now going to paraphrase, where you talk about innovation. The term is completely agnostic about whether these things and practices are good. Crack cocaine, you instance, was a highly innovative product in the 80s, involved a great deal of entrepreneurship, and generated lots of revenue. Innovation, entrepreneurship. And you say perhaps the point is cynical, but it draws our attention to a perverse reality. Contemporary discourse treats innovation as a positive value in itself when it is not.
That's right. I mean, I try to make clear that it's not like we're opposed to innovation. That's not the issue. The issue is that innovation is totally agnostic about values. And so we say instead of losing sight of what matters, we should focus on those values that we want to see in our society, what we really want to see come about. And that starts to make innovation policy look different, right? It's not about spurring on any technological change. It's about spurring on those technological changes that we really need in our society, like, you know, technologies for mitigating greenhouse gases and things like that. So to focus on innovation as a value misses the point that we have more fundamental values that need our attention.
I find this a really seductive argument, Lee, and I'm glad you're putting it, and more power to you. And I hope that you're able to maintain your energy level. Lee is Assistant Professor of Science and Technology Studies at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I'm most grateful for your time for our little program. You might like to stick around, Lee, and have a listen to the next story, because it's about a very innovative bloke, a neurologist who hacked his own brain. LNL on RN. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Late Night Live has just blown the fuse, lack of maintenance. Earlier this year, I did an interview which seems to encompass both innovation and maintenance. So while we fix our little problem, here's the story of the man who hacked his own brain. We replay it by unpopular demand. Over the years, you will remember, dear listener, we've had many a chat with Oliver Sacks, and I wish he was around today because he would thoroughly enjoy the next story, because it seems to take over where he left off. It's about a bloke called Philip Kennedy, who had this big dream throughout his career to give people with brain damage the ability to control a computer directly with their thoughts. And this would involve a form of hacking, which, as you know, is defined as the hacker is defined as someone who seeks and explains or exploits weaknesses in a computer system or network. Now, it seems that hacking your own brain isn't entirely legal in the United States, so the bloke we're discussing had to find a friendly surgeon, and he did so in the Central American country of Belize. Now, in 2014, Dr. Philip Kennedy left his thriving medical practice in Georgia and headed south to the Caribbean to literally tap into his brain. Now, earlier this year, science writer Daniel Ingber, who writes for Slate, New York Times Magazine, Wired, among other distinguished outlets, wrote about Kennedy's operation, why he did it, and the after effects. The story was published in Wired and was called "The Neurologist Who Hacked His Brain and Almost Lost His Mind," and even the title recalls one of Oliver Sacks, I think. And Daniel joins us via Skype from his home in New York. Daniel, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thanks for having me.
It's an amazing story, isn't it? Let's begin by briefly describing what happened to the good doctor when he arrives in Belize.
Well, he actually made a few trips to Belize. He first went down with one of his prior patients to try to get to do a surgery on him, a guy named Eric Ramsey. So that was his first trip. He did a surgery then where he was assisting in performing the surgery. Then he went down later in 2014 to have the surgery done on himself.
And I understand that when he came out of the anesthesia, the world was somewhat mysterious to him.
Right. Well, he went in, he had an 11 and a half hour brain surgery. And the idea was to have three or four electrodes implanted in his cortex. And these were going to be as non-invasive as electrodes in your cortex can be. That's what he hoped. And he expected there would be no side effects. But when he came out of the surgery, at first he started having seizures, and then he found himself unable to talk.
Very, very minor side effects, I would have thought.
Yeah. Well, so not only was he unable to talk, but as he started to panic and realized that, you know, he had the words in his head, he just couldn't create the words with his mouth. He would start to talk and the word wouldn't come to him. He would see a pen and he would just keep start. He would get the P sound, but he wouldn't get the word out. He beckoned for pencil and paper. And so we thought, okay, I'll just write down what's happening and communicate with my doctors this way. And when he started to write on the paper, he just started scrawling kind of incomprehensible arcane symbols.
Now, you visited him last year to have a chat, and he showed you the video of the surgery.
Yeah, that's right. I went to visit him at his clinic, neurology clinic and lab outside Atlanta, Georgia. And we sat and talked about his research and why he did this. And while we did, we watched a video of the surgery that had taken place in Belize. And so he kind of walked me through the opening of his skull, the pulling back of the membrane that covers the cortex, and then digging around and placing the electrodes in there.
I suddenly remember a marvelous series of Doonesbury when we were given a guided tour of Ronald Reagan's brain. Anyway, so he's a pretty interesting bloke. He'd already had a significant career as a neurologist, hadn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's one of the first people to implant an electrode in someone's brain for a medical purpose. So he had he's for many years has worked with locked-in patients, that is those who, because of a brainstem stroke or ALS or some other neurodegenerative condition, are kind of trapped in their bodies and unable to communicate in any way. So Phil Kennedy has tried using these electrode implants to provide a way for these patients to communicate. So he started doing that, I think, almost 20 years ago now.
I mentioned that he has had this passion for direct communication between brain and computer. He's not the first neuroscientist to push this concept. Tell us about the Spanish neurologist, José Delgado.
Well, José Delgado is a nearly forgotten scientist at this point. He's still alive. I believe he lives in California. But at one time in the mid-20th century, he was world famous for his brain experiments. And what he would do was he had invented these things he called stimosievers that were electrodes that he could implant in the brain that would both deliver little shocks and also they could pick up the brain's electrical activity and it could be recorded and analyzed. So his most famous experiment, which was on the front page of the New York Times, he went to a bull ring in Spain and he had implanted one of these stimosievers in a bull. And then he got in the ring with a bull. He flashed his cape. The bull started charging at him. And then he just had this little remote control and he pressed one button and it stopped the animal in its tracks. And he pressed another button and the bull, in a docile way, marched off towards the side of the bull ring. And that was it. That was his grand presentation.
I remember this extraordinary event. And then he wanted to use the same techniques in people, but inevitably he ran into a few problems.
Well, he wasn't inciting people to charge at him and then using a remote control to make them walk in different directions. But he did implant this in people with various types of mental illness. There were various magazine profiles of him that I looked at for the story, and he has these really grandiose ideas of what this will mean. He's going to unlock human potential. He's going to allow us to record exactly what goes on in the brain and then to intervene, manipulate the brain to not only cure mental illness, but to enhance human abilities. And this was in the 1970s, and there was a backlash to all of this, and people became very uncomfortable with that kind of talk, and Delgado's work fell out of favor, and not many people tried to do anything so extreme as implanting electrodes in human patients.
Daniel, I have a great interest in using this technology on guests so I could sit them in the studio. And my producers are very interested in what you're saying because they wanted to implant the damn thing in me. This is Alien L tonight on RN On Air Online and on your pod, and we're hacking brains with Daniel Ingber. Okay, so Philip Kennedy has this big dream, and he wants to extrapolate from Delgado. In the 1990s, he makes a breakthrough in brain research that went further than other neurologists. What was it, Daniel?
Well, he was working on in sort of a bioengineering lab, and he had an idea for. So one of the problems is when you start implanting electrodes in humans, certainly, but also in monkeys or mice or any living animal, it's a violent thing to do. You're taking a piece of metal and you're poking it into the brain and you're damaging neural tissue and you're creating scar tissue. And over time, this bare wire is going to wiggle around again, shearing through more brain tissue. So the problem has always been that you can poke one of these things in, but it's not going to last very long. Eventually, all of the brain cells nearby are just going to have been killed, and so whatever signal you are picking up is going to disappear. So that's just a problem in neuroscience for a long time. Dr. Kennedy had this idea that if he could create a certain kind of electrode that kind of weaves itself into the brain tissue in more of an organic way, that it would be a longer lasting implant and a longer lasting intervention. So his idea was he takes the electrode, the metal wire, and he puts it inside a glass cone. This is still a very small device, but it's a wire encased in glass. And then he paints the inside of the glass with what are called neurotrophic factors. These are chemicals that promote the growth of brain cells. And the idea was if you implant this thing in the brain tissue and then you just wait, first there'll be, you know, the damage to the area that you'll have to deal with. But eventually nearby brain cells will kind of send out their little processes, their dendrites that will curl in and around the glass cone, and they'll kind of ensnarl it into the living fabric of the brain. So that was Kennedy's idea, and it worked. And he was able to implant these cone electrodes and leave them in place in his rats and his monkeys for months at a time, and he believes that they could last for years.
And then he finds a patient, a human patient, to use it on, a Vietnam veteran with the unforgettable name of Johnny Ray.
Yeah, Johnny Ray. So he and his collaborator, a guy named Roy Bakai, have finally get approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to implant these cone electrodes into a human patient. The idea, again, was they want to find someone who's unable to talk, who's unable to move in any obvious way, and they're going to use this electrode to try to read brain signals directly from the patient and then convert those brain signals into some kind of language. So they they find this 52-year-old Vietnam veteran who had had a brainstem stroke, who was on a ventilator and could only move by twitching his shoulder up and down a little bit on one side, and I think he could move an eyebrow very slightly. So he wasn't totally unable to communicate. He could sort of answer yes and no questions by blinking once or twice. But what Kennedy did with these electrodes, he was able to give Johnny Ray a way to control a cursor on a computer screen just by thinking. He had to train up once he had this electrode in place. And after a while, he was able to reliably send a signal to the computer and move a cursor from left to right on a screen.
Well, this is a miraculous moment, because he learns to modulate the signals from his implant just by thinking.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is something that there had been work with monkeys, to allow monkeys to use prosthetic arms just by thinking about it. They could try to grab a piece of food, learning how to manipulate their own brain signals with this implant. Now, this is the first time in 1998 that this has been done with a human patient for a specific clinical purpose. And Kennedy referred to his patient, Johnny Ray, as the world's first cyborg. And I don't think that's an unreasonable description.
No, little wonder that suddenly Kennedy's a media sensation, being compared to the likes of Alexander Graham Bell.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there were stories about this all around the world. Certainly here in the U.S., Phil Kennedy was on TV many times. He was on the front pages of the newspaper. I mean, this was a huge news story.
Over the years, I've talked on our little wireless program to a great many of the most famous science fiction writers, from Ray Bradbury to Arthur C. Clarke, but I didn't realise that your bloke also was a science fiction writer, in that he wrote a book to fictionalise these ideas.
Yes, he wrote it under a fake name. I would describe it as softcore pornography. It's erotic science fiction, let's say. And the hero of this book is a scientist similar to Phil Kennedy himself, who was born in Ireland, invented a special kind of electrode that could be implanted in the brain and left there for a long time, pioneered these brain machine interfaces for controlling computers, and then he imagines how this will be used in the world to come, and it is not a happy world. He imagines a time where Chinese nanobots are taking over the planet.
Don't let Donald Trump hear about this.
There's a Trumpism that runs through the book, although he wrote it before Donald Trump had ever gone into politics.
How is he viewed by his colleagues after the brain hacking, with all the ethical issues involved that must frighten off a lot of neuroscientists?
I mean, I had the sense, I talked to a large number of people in this field, and I found myself as the messenger here. Most of them had not heard that Phil had had taken the step to perform this experiment on himself, and they were a little bit in awe of him for having done this. They were stupefied, I would say, as well, and I think they thought it was a bold and amazing thing. Phil is able to create a data set that is unlike any that has been created thus far. I mean, this is an experiment that would not be permitted under normal circumstances. The only reason it happened here is because Phil Kennedy knew how to, you know, he understood all the risks. He'd invented this electrode. He'd assisted in this surgery himself. He chose to do this, you know, he consented to his own experiment, and then he had to leave the country. So this is not something that could be repeated, and it's not something I think will be repeated. So they were amazed by that, but at the same time, I think many of his colleagues were sort of taken aback that, that Phil would try something so extreme.
You say in your article that Kennedy was himself once a famous neurologist, the past tense.
Yes, well, so in 1998, he's world famous, or as world famous as any research neurologist can be. But in the years that come, his research sort of fell out of favor. So he implanted several more patients. Progress was pretty slow in terms of creating a really viable communication method using these electrodes. So I said Johnny Ray could move a cursor left to right. Well, that meant he could spell out words through this incredibly time-consuming, laborious practice of just sort of selecting letters off a screen. I mean, much slower than what Stephen Hawking does, let's say. So Kennedy was doing this stuff, and it was going slowly. And in the meantime, other technologies took hold and became more popular in this subfield of neurology, namely a method that involves, that's less invasive, where you still open up the skin on the top of the head and you take a piece of the skull out, but instead of plunging a single electrode into the through the surface of the brain, you just take a kind of a grid of electrodes and you drape them across the top of the brain. So that became the state of the art in how to do this sort of research. And Phil Kennedy was and remains convinced that his cone electrodes are the way to do it. So he became kind of out of step.
You're giving too much information now. My producers are taking notes, and and I hate to think what's going to happen when I get off air. I want to read the final para of your article to the listener. In Georgia, I asked Kennedy if he'd ever do the experiment again. On myself, he asks. No, I shouldn't do this again. I mean, Certainly not on the same side. And he taps his temple where the cone electrode tips are still lodged. Then, as if energized by the idea of putting implants on the other side of his brain, he launches into plans for making new electrodes and more sophisticated implants. Is anyone else doing this?
not like he's done it. There's no one else who's heading to out of the country to get this done, as far as I know. And one of the things is, you know, he has all this data, but he doesn't really know what to do with it, because I believe that the medical journals won't publish this data because of the bizarre circumstances under which it was accrued. So I don't think anyone else would do this.
Daniel, thank you very much for that. It's a wonderful yarn, and it's beautifully done by Daniel Engber, science writer. His article, The Neurologist Who Hacked His Brain and Almost Lost His Mind, was published in the January issue of Wired magazine. Good on you, Daniel.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Good on you, Daniel Engber. Thank you very much for that. And that's your lot for the week of the Little Wireless program. And four cheers to the team. To Anna Whitfield, to Sasha Fegan, get well soon, Sash, to Stan Corrie and Ruth Slee, Tim Jenkins, and up here in Musselbrook, my old mate Michael Pritchard. Now it is required that you sit absolutely still and listen to the news.